I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Question for you. Did the housing vouchers that were intended as a well-meaning way to move people out of violent public housing also, unintentionally, move the violence? We'll take on that topic. But first, after more than a year of bitter debate, the U.S. Senate is expected today to pass a terrorism surveillance bill that would legalize parts of the president's secret wiretapping program. President Bush halted the program only after it was revealed by the New York Times in December of 2006. Congress then passed a law temporarily allowing the program, but that legislation expires next month. The current bill would overhaul the 1978 Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, known as FISA, which set up a secret court to oversee just such government wiretaps. But at the heart of the debate is the fact that the bill would also retroactively protect from civil lawsuits phone companies that help the government eavesdrop on Americans without going through the FISA courts. Today, senators on both sides of the aisle fired their parting volleys on the issue. First, Republican Orrin Hatch of Utah said the critics were the same conspiracy theorists who believed in secret military actions.
Many of the people who make arguments against this should join the black helicopter crowd and wear tinfoil hats, and I think they'd be in greater company.
But Democratic Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin took issue with that remark and went on to say that he can't believe senators are still arguing over whether the original FISA program was legal or whether the Bush current plan of notifying only a handful of Congress members was enough.
I cannot believe that we are still debating the legality of this program in the Senate floor, and that anyone seriously believes that merely notifying the Gang of Eight senators and congressmen, while keeping the full Intelligence Committee in the dark, somehow represents congressional approval.
Well, joining us with more, Evan Perez of the Wall Street Journal. Evan, we know so far that this bill, which is going to be voted on, would both pull in the reins on some secret eavesdropping while easing restrictions on others. So lay it out for us.
Well, that's correct. Essentially, the law is going to ease the burden, and this is one of the key things that the administration wanted, which was to reduce the number of times and the amount of paperwork that a lot of intelligence officers have to go through to be able to do their work. So on one hand, it for example, allows the government to get more broad warrants that exist for longer and that will cover more people, essentially. And it allows sort of a broader, for the warrants to be more broad in how they set out to do surveillance.
But do they have to go through a FISA court? Do they have to go through a court?
Right, exactly. And on the flip side, the administration has granted for there to be more oversight by the FISA court, which is a court that will be able to take a look at these warrants, and especially when it has to do with Americans overseas, will be able to render judgment on whether or not it's warranted. Currently, the Attorney General can just sign these warrants and they get done.
Well, we understand that there are about 40 lawsuits pending against the phone companies that cooperated with the administration on warrantless wiretaps. And the president wanted the bill to include a provision that would protect them. Tell us more about, what the bill will say.
The argument has been that because these lawsuits are still in the courts, there's a lot that we don't know about the post 9/11 warrantless surveillance program that was operated by the NSA. Only a few members of Congress have been briefed on it, and the Congress is now being asked to give a retroactive immunity to these telecom providers for something that they argue, a lot of them argue, they still don't know whether it was legal. The administration says it's very important that phone companies, for the phone companies and telecom companies, to be reassured that aiding the government in its fight on terrorism is now something that they're going to get sued over. So it's a very pitched argument, as you can tell.
Well, but isn't part of the argument that how can some senators know whether or not to let the phone companies off the hook until they know exactly what the phone companies did? They're calling for an investigation, right?
That's right. I mean, there's still, a lot of people who are going to vote for this today and are going to be very, but they're going to be holding their nose because they still don't know what essentially they're passing immunity for. There is some of this, still will be subject to some litigation. I think there are some groups out there, civil liberties groups, that are going to find ways to file lawsuits against the government and try to direct the litigation against the government, and if not against the phone companies, because at least that way, perhaps they can pursue some way of outing some of the details of this program.
And Evan, just in the few seconds we have, is it pretty much a done deal? Are you pretty confident that this bill will pass?
Yes, it's a done deal. The leadership in the House and Senate have signed off to it, and they're gonna do it. As you know, in this election season, Senator Obama has signed on to it. I think the Democrats have made the calculation that they'd like to get this over with. They know they're going to be upsetting some people on the left, but I think they'd like to get those people upset now and perhaps give them a chance to get over it before November.
So some political calculations as well.
Absolutely.
Today. Evan Perez of the Wall Street Journal speaking to us about the bill on the Senate floor that would overhaul but still keep some of the president's warrantless wiretapping program. Evan, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Crime rates in major cities have fallen over the last decade and a half. For example, in New York City in 2005, violent crime hit a near 50-year low. But as crime in big cities falls, a lot of smaller cities are seeing a dramatic uptick by as much as 20% a year. And according to our next guest, the primary reason is something researchers and housing activists don't want to hear. Hannah Rosen is a contributing editor for the Atlantic Monthly. She wrote the article American Murder Mystery for this month's magazine and joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. to take us through it. Hannah, welcome.
Thank you.
What are some of the cities where crime is rising? I'm reading Florence, South Carolina, for instance. Where else?
There's the city where I wrote my story out of, which is Memphis, Tennessee. There's Reading, Pennsylvania, Orlando, Florida, Kansas City, Missouri. These are sort of mid-sized cities which we're not used to in our imagination thinking of as hot spots or crime centers. They're not places where you see, a lot of cop shows or murder mysteries being staged.
Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina, Orlando, Florida. So tell us, in Memphis, Tennessee, where you spent some time, how are officials there seeing this increase in crime?
The pattern of crime has changed dramatically in Memphis in the last 5 or 6 years, such that crime used to be focused in a downtown area. And then suddenly crime began to spread all around the city, basically an inner ring around the city where crime began to increase over the last 5, 10 years.
And they're seeing things like, cars with bullet holes and dead bodies where they might have seen break-ins before.
Exactly. I start the story from the perspective of one cop who grew up in this neighborhood in Memphis and who, remembers precisely the moment when he knew that things had changed, and it was the moment where there was a sort of crime movie scene unfolding before his eyes in a neighborhood which, as he described, the hottest thing happening was when the cops would meet for choir practice in the Safeway parking lot. That's how bored they were. And so in this case, he saw a car he described it as looking like Swiss cheese, just full of bullet holes one day, and he was an investigator at the time and tried to track down what had happened, and he got one guy to talk to him, but the guy wouldn't give up any names. And then 2 weeks later, he heard about a similar car, and this time the dead guy was inside, and it was his witness. Mm-hmm. And so he felt like he was living in a completely different city. It's like, how did I find myself in South Central or other Bronx? I thought I was just, some guy living in a Memphis suburb.
Well, you talk about two researchers who stumbled on an explanation for this increase in crime in small cities, decrease in the inner city. First of all, Richard Janikowski, a criminologist for the University of Memphis, and his wife, Phyllis Betts, who's a housing expert at the University of Memphis. Tell us, first of all, about Janikowski's finds and then Betts' finds.
Richard Janikowski just has a very close relationship with the police department. He's got it such that he's gotten them to send him arrest statistics every single day. So he's able to track crime block by block, murder by murder throughout the whole region. Phyllis Betts is a housing expert at the university. And what she does is she helps the city track the outcome of certain housing reforms. In this case, these two researchers happen to be married. And so after a while, they noticed that they were doing their field work in the same neighborhoods. They were always going out to the same places.
Well, and this is fascinating. They both made maps. Janikowski, maps of increase in crime and where crime was flaring up. He saw he said a bunny rabbit pattern. The inner city, the body of the rabbit, was absolutely clean, where crime used to be concentrated, but it had spread out through these sort of rabbit ears. Betts, his wife, the housing expert, had made a map of where the city had demolished housing projects and people had used what's called Section 8 vouchers to move out of those projects. They lay the maps over each other. What did they find?
It was kind of amazing. I mean, these are two completely separate maps, different sets of data. One is done in, you know, patterns of dark blue and light blue. Betts' map is done in little red dots, which show where Section 8 vouchers residents had moved. So they overlay their maps, and what they find is a near exact match between the city's new hotspots, hotspots being a police term for places where violent crime has ticked up, and that matches almost exactly to where Section 8 vouchers had moved.
All right, well, let's remind ourselves of the history of these so-called Section 8 vouchers. It's a fight that started years ago to move inner-city, poor, largely minority people from public housing that had become prisons for them. It started with an ACLU class action lawsuit against the Housing Authority in Chicago. The ACLU won the lawsuit. What was the purpose of these Section 8 vouchers?
Well, this was considered the unfinished business of the civil rights legislation, and it goes a long way towards explaining why Phyllis Betts, when she saw the perfect match between these maps, was disheartened rather than excited. The man who started this lawsuit, who's a man named Alexander Polakoff, is a hero to people like Phyllis Betts, because what he discovered is if you were poor, an African-American in Chicago, and you wanted to leave your inner-city housing project, the city basically wouldn't let you go anywhere except for a predominantly minority neighborhood. And he decided that this was racist. And he sued and sued in a series of several lawsuits. And this led in 1976 to a Supreme Court decision, which many people compared to Brown v. Board of Education, which basically said that you could move anywhere in the city. And the compromise they came up with was they invented, essentially, these things called Section 8 vouchers, which became a permanent government program. And these Section 8 vouchers would guarantee that a certain percentage of rent would be paid, but you could move into a private residence. So, you know, you'd have landlords who would or wouldn't accept Section 8 vouchers, and then you could move there and the landlord would be guaranteed that they would get a certain portion of rent from the government.
And the tenant had to pay 25% of the rent, but it meant that people could pick up and move to the suburbs. Initially, the results were spectacular. These former public housing residents did far better than their counterparts who stayed in public housing.
Yes, and there was a famous experiment. It was called the Gautreaux experiment, named after the woman who was initially the head of the lawsuit. The Gautreaux experiment basically took dozens of families, and they were handpicked families. They had to go through a screening process. They were moved into predominantly white middle-class or upper-middle-class neighborhoods. And there were a couple of researchers who tracked their progress for a number of years, and the studies were released in the early 90s, and they were fabulous. I mean, they showed that the kids were more likely to go to school, the mothers were more likely to work, and more importantly, these studies were hailed in a lot of different places, on the front page of the New York Times, Time and Newsweek. There was a big 60-minute special. It became sort of one of the rare success stories of American anti-poverty reform.
But then what happened? Because, as Hannah writes, this early success led to great support for Section 8 vouchers over the next 15 years. Thousands of housing projects demolished, former residents moved into the suburbs, and as we heard, a bunny ear map then showed violence followed them. Why? There are many reasons, as we'll hear. Be back in 1 minute, here and now. We've been looking at the history and unintended consequences of the popular anti-poverty Section 8 vouchers from 1976, when a lawyer named Alexander Polakoff fought against white fear of blacks moving into their neighborhoods, to win a momentous Supreme Court decision that allowed people to move with government vouchers out of public housing into the near suburbs, to today, when a housing expert at the University of Memphis named Phyllis Betts realized that Memphis's escalating crime occurred in neighborhoods where people with Section 8 vouchers had moved. Our guest is Hannah Rosen. She wrote American Murder Mystery for this month's Atlantic Monthly. Hannah, let's get to what went wrong. You visited a complex in North Memphis where many former residents of a housing project had moved when their project was demolished. You meet a woman who said her new gated community started to feel like her old housing project.
I go to visit a woman named Leslie Shaw, who had been in a place called Dixie Homes, which was one of the housing projects that had been knocked down. I visited Leslie a couple of years after she moved, and the place had at first seemed very attractive to her. The walls were clean. You know, it had been advertised as a gated community. But, of course, Leslie moved there because a lot of her friends from Dixie Homes moved there, because realistically, if no researcher is pushing us to move to a certain neighborhood, we're not going to move to completely alien territory. We're going to move to where our friends go, to a place that's relatively familiar. familiar. So Leslie moves there, and over 2 years, the place starts to slowly deteriorate. So people start to break the gates. People start to steal the computers. People start to break into other people's houses. Slowly, that neighborhood very much starts to look like the old Dixie Homes neighborhood that Leslie Shaw left.
Well, and here's where civil rights activists and researchers like Phyllis Betts get sick to their stomachs. Because the thinking had been that the violence that you saw in these prison-like housing projects was because of the projects, was because people were so trapped there. Now researchers start asking themselves, is it the people who are bringing the behavior with them? But you say that there are other explanations for the reasons that this violence is following the people. They weren't prepared. They weren't coached as many were for, let's say, welfare reform. It was just a sudden divorce from the life that they'd known.
Right. It was a sudden get up and move. I mean, here's where we're getting into very dangerous territory in terms of sort of the American conversation and why this happens and why people don't like to talk about it. Because take a city like Memphis, which has had a lot of gruesome murders and rape cases in the last couple of years, which have been well publicized. You are basically serving up racial stereotypes in a city that already has a lot of white fear. You're going back to this notion that Alexander Polakoff tried to fight against, which is this idea, oh, these people are going to come and ruin my neighborhood. So this is where even writing the story, and for someone like Phyllis Betts talking about this, because she is white and the city has a predominantly African-American leadership, is a little bit difficult. Mm-hmm. So step one is to just get people to actually acknowledge that this is happening, that there are new patterns, that basically you haven't really created anything new. You've just created similar kinds of neighborhoods all around the city, which have, you know, slightly modified new kinds of dysfunction.
Well, you list a lot of reasons. There's a loss of community, loss of services. If you were living in a housing project, there might be health services, for instance, right in the project, and now you have to travel. Often people can't travel. But also, in the 30s, 40s, 50s, white communities kept blacks out through bombs, mobs, zoning, redistricting. But now it's more nuanced. How can minorities move into suburbs when there's no housing available, when there are landlords who won't take vouchers? So in effect, they're forced to move into, let's say, African-American communities that are just above public housing.
Yeah, and when, frankly, they have no transportation, so they have no way to get back and forth. There are no real jobs available out there anymore. The schools aren't necessarily better. It turned out that just by giving people a voucher, you didn't really solve all of their problems, and in some cases, you created a lot of new problems. And also, I did not meet a single person who didn't miss the housing project for many, many reasons. And I think part of it is a sense of community and identity, you know, just this really strange feeling of dislocation that people had that didn't really know necessarily what to do with themselves. Some of it was just basic services, like the infant mortality rate is going up. You know, why is that true? Because the hospitals that serve and teach people who need the serving and teaching stayed in the inner city. They didn't move out to the suburbs with the populations. And so you've got this kind of disconnect between services. Childcare is a very basic one. You tell people to find jobs. Well, there were these kind of child care centers and providers downtown, which really don't exist out in the places where people live now. And so you're asking people to take, you know, who knows how many buses to get downtown and then get to work. So it really is kind of a mess at this point. And then crime is just the icing on the cake. And that's the one people really, really don't like to talk about and which needs a whole lot more research. Because I think if you don't get that problem under control, you really can't fix any of the others.
And it's really interesting that the crime is largely black on black.
Yes, I mean, that's what Phyllis Betts likes to argue, because she has gotten a lot of heat from city officials, basically people accusing her of repeating the same old arguments that Alexander Polakoff fought against. And that's her argument. Look, it's not me and you who are suffering from this. I can just move further east to my suburb, which is exactly what she did and which is exactly what a lot of other people do. These are middle-class African-American families. And even more, these are poor black people who, in some cases, were promised something which is not being delivered to them. And so that's always her argument when people say she's bordering on racism.
Well, what happens now? What's been the reaction to the article, and what's some of the thinking about what happens next?
There's been several layers of reaction. I would say one reaction has come from academics who are pretty reluctant to accept this as the conclusion of the housing reform. I think what a lot of people are afraid of is if you talk about this, well, it's much easier for governments to just cut off all funding for housing. So there's a reluctance even to acknowledge the landscape as I described it. So I think that's step one. Step two, I mean, Phyllis Betts is starting to lay out some of this, as are some other on-the-ground people in different cities around the country, which is, can you connect services to people? For example, police departments and researchers are starting to make a lot of connections with apartment managers. It's like, can we use that vacant apartment downstairs to actually put in some social services, access to childcare, social workers? And I think police departments are starting to do a lot of what's called hotspot policing, which is, you know, doing what Janikowski has laid out, which is that you create these maps and you really track block to block where the new crime is, and you try and get some handle on it so you can move on from there.
Hannah Rosen is contributing editor for The Atlantic Monthly. Her article in this month's magazine is American Murder Mystery: Why is Crime Rising in So Many American Cities? The answer implicates one of the most celebrated anti-poverty programs of recent decades, the Section 8 vouchers. Hannah, thanks so much for speaking to us about it. It's fascinating.
My pleasure.
Okay, still ahead today, a lesson in entomophagy. If you're having lunch, you might want to put it aside. It's after the news, here and now. And what now for the approximately 270 terrorism suspects still being held at the U.S. military's detention center at Guantanamo Bay? Last month's Supreme Court ruling granted them the right to appear in U.S. court. Lawyers for about 200 detainees are now taking their cases to federal court in Washington. And yesterday, the judge overseeing those cases said it's time to clear everything else off the docket and move them forward. But how? Most have been detained for years, and so far only 19 have been charged with crimes. In a moment, we'll get the view from Guantanamo Bay. But first, joining us, Emmy McLean, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. They're helping to coordinate the 200-something lawyers who want to bring detainee cases to court in Washington. And Emmy, the judge, Thomas Hogan, held a hearing yesterday with, what, these 200 lawyers? Some on the phone? You listened in from New York. What was that like?
It was really quite extraordinary. For many of these men, this is the first time that they've had the beginning of their day in court. Of course, it was dealing with many of the procedural issues that are at play at the early stages of this, rather than an individual hearing, which is what we're pushing for now. But it was extraordinary to have this day in court, which is what we've been pushing for 6.5 years.
Yeah, and you mentioned that your group is arguing for individual lawyers and individual courtrooms for each detainee. The government wants similar cases sort of bundled together. The judge wants everything to get to the courts quickly. Wouldn't your position of having individual lawyers and individual courtrooms really take quite a bit of time?
No. The fact of the matter is what habeas hearings are about are individual judges considering the facts of individual cases based on the legal issues that are at play. And this is what we've been pushing for 6.5 years and saying that courts are trained to do. This is what individual judges can do. What the government has been trying to do over this same period of time is use delaying tactics, coordination, forcing big legal questions to be resolved before any of these facts get before courtrooms. What we've seen is that any time facts get to an individual judge, the judge has been very skeptical of the facts that are produced.
Well, in fact, the Justice Department, your opponent in these detainee cases, has brought in new lawyers and asked for time to update the evidence. What did Judge Hogan say to that request yesterday?
Judge Hogan seemed quite skeptical of that and seemed amenable to the position that we've been taking, which is that if there is a need to update the evidence in an individual case, then the Department of Justice should be able to present the court with specific reasons why they would need to update the evidence. There's been no ruling thus far. We're expecting a ruling on some of these outstanding questions on Thursday or Friday.
Well, the government says it's already cleared 1 out of 5 of the remaining 270 or so detainees for release. But they say that one of their big problems is they can't find a country for these detainees to go to. In fact, they say further that they may have to release even more detainees for different reasons, that they can't reveal evidence because it's top secret, for instance, they can't go to court with it, and that they might have to release these dangerous detainees onto U.S. streets. What did the judge respond to that at all, or do you have a response to that?
Well, Well, the government has been holding these people for 6.5 years, and they should have, at this point, some evidence that they can present to a court. And remember, a habeas hearing is not a full criminal trial. It's a pretty basic standard of evidence which the government needs to adhere to. And if they can't present that for the men that they've been holding for 6.5 years, then they should not be holding them anymore.
I'm reading the exchange in the AP. Apparently, the Justice Department said the executive branch is struggling with this issue of finding countries to send the detainees to. And Judge Hogan responded, maybe we can assist them. He seems to be really wanting to push this forward.
He certainly seems to be wanting to push this forward. And we need to remember that the Supreme Court in the Bemidian decision last month said very clearly that the cost of delay should no longer be borne by the men who are in custody.
And what about the other government argument that if all these detainees are released with no country to go to, they'll flood the streets of the U.S.?
Well, there are certainly arguments that the government is making. Most of the men who are held there, they can be returned to their home countries. They should be returned to their home countries. We need to remember there's 275 men who are in Guantanamo, and 100 of them are from Yemen, which is a country that is willing to take them back, and the U.S. has so far refused to return more than a dozen men to Yemen. So that's an argument that the government has been making, which is not true for the majority of the men who are there.
Emmy McLean, staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, helping coordinate the legal cases of terrorism suspects being held at Guantanamo Bay. Emmy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much.
Well, we turn now to Carol Rosenberg, a reporter for the Miami Herald, who's been covering the military commissions. These are the military trials for detainees at Guantanamo Bay. The first one is scheduled in July, late July, for Salim Hamdan, the former driver for Osama bin Laden. Carol is at Guantanamo Bay. And we're just wondering, Carol, why are these commissions even still being considered if, in fact, the Supreme Court ruled that these detainees have the right to a regular trial?
The short and simple answer to that question is that no judge up in Washington has stopped these trials. The military commissions are the Pentagon's war court with military officers serving as judges and jurors and lawyers, defense lawyers and prosecutors, and they have not been told by a judge in Washington to stop the trials.
We understand that there is a judge in Washington that is going to decide next week about whether Hamdan's military commission should even take place. But in the meantime, what does it feel like there for you? I mean, does it feel as if everyone is still going about preparing for the commissions?
You know, for all the momentousness of what happened yesterday in the federal courts, it's pretty much business as usual here. You've still got It's about 265 men as detainees, foreigners being held as enemy combatants. You've got a case this afternoon where a Saudi man, Mustafa Hausawi, who they say financed the September 11th attacks, is going to be at the war court. There's going to be a hearing. It's a pretrial hearing. And, yes, the Supreme Court did decide that these guys have rights in federal courts, but down here, none of those rights have actually been extended quite yet.
And yet there was also a report that the courtroom itself, the physical courtroom, wasn't ready there. Is it ready now?
Yes. I mean, a couple of months ago, they took that courtroom out for a test drive, and it failed. Lights, the electronics, the video. By June 5th, the time when the men in the September 11th attacks were arraigned, the courtroom was working. And they've even now built a briefing room that looks like a stage set from the Pentagon where they're going to have press conferences.
Well, I understand the military jury pool is going to be called in from around the world for this possible trial of Hamdan on July 21st. But what happens if the judge holds up the Hamdan trial?
What we're hearing is on July 18th, Judge Robertson in Washington will decide whether to order a halt to the trial of the driver, Salim Hamdan. And if he orders that on the 18th, I guess the military won't be able to bring in the military jury from around the world on July 19th.
When Judge Robertson rules on the driver's trial, will that ruling apply to all military commissions?
You know, that's the big question everybody down here is asking. If Judge Robertson stops the driver's trial, will the Pentagon go ahead and try to continue with other trials, or will they see that as a signal that all of the military commissions have to end? But first, we have to hear from Judge Robertson on whether he's going to stop the driver's trial.
That's Carol Rosenberg, a reporter for the Miami Herald, speaking to us from the detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, where she'll cover the first military court hearings of terrorism suspects if they go forward. Carol, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, up next, Joshi, a story for you and other adventurous 8-year-olds. You're listening to Here and Now. The sound of dinner? Well, why not? 60% of a cricket is valuable protein, and the web is awash with sites about how to eat bugs. Oh, look, a recipe for mealworm chocolate chip cookies. Of course, it's not for everyone, but David Gracer is trying to change that. He's touring the country to spread the gospel of entomophagy. That's the practice of eating insects. He joins us from the studios of WRNI in Providence. David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What's the draw for you?
I see insects as a real solution to problems, potentially serious problems in, for example, food production. I have been fond of saying that cows and pigs are the SUVs of the food world and bugs are the bicycles. Insects are much better at feeding large numbers of people, and that's what we have on the planet.
Well, what about public health risk?
A certain amount of research shows that insects tend to be somewhat less prone to disease and parasites and infection than vertebrates. There's really no mad cricket disease the way there is for mad cow. So overall, it seems to be less fraught with risk.
Okay. Well, we finally come to what is the real American taboo, because insects are eaten around the world. You know, there's the ugh factor. I mean, you know, people just don't, it's not appealing.
It's true, despite the fact, of course, that we'll eat ocean bugs, but not land bugs. Crab, shrimp, and lobster, highly normal, and there's that massive logical disconnect. And how do you overcome that? Well, with a sense of humor and a sense of, I suppose, a food adventure.
Well, let's have one, shall we? Because you were kind enough to send us a box of toasted crickets. And here is the point of the program where I am not going to eat them. Our intern, Hamad, is. Hamad?
Oh, yes. Robin.
Describe what you've got there, Hamad.
I have a plastic bag with what looks like wood chips, but it's actually dead crickets and they've been toasted.
Okay, go ahead, Hamad.
All right, I'm just going to put it in my mouth whole.
It might crunch, so.
It's a little bit like smoked sand.
Wait, when have you tasted smoked sand?
Well, it's actually not bad. It's just gritty, but the taste is actually nice.
Hamad, did that bother you? I mean, first of all, for some listeners who we've lost at this point, our apologies, but did that bother you? I mean, you just went right with that.
It's really the eyes and the head that's bothering me, but, you know, the abdomen, to me, that's just like any other animal meat.
And to deal with the problems of eyes and heads, I have been working with cricket flour. So those crickets
I thought you were going to say blindfolds, but go ahead.
Oh, I see.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's a lot of small blindfolds.
You were talking about flour.
Yes. Well, it's very easy to dry crickets and grind them into flour that has all of the nutritional benefits of the insects without asking people to go ahead and eat the whole bug.
You do have a big hurdle to overcome here in the U.S., and you're trying. I mean, you're going to restaurants and visiting with chefs. So what are you finding? What's happening?
There are a few restaurants around the country that serve insects, and now there's one in Providence, Rhode Island, that serves them.
What kind?
They have served cicada, silkworm pupa, termites, and they're going to feature at least two different varieties on the menu on a permanent basis.
You also sent us the Formiga colunas, which are the leafcutter ants that are a delicacy in Colombia. How much do they go for per pound?
Something like $60 to $70 a pound.
Really?
Yes. In fact, in other places as well, if you go to the marketplace too late in the day, the chicken and the vegetables may be there, but the insects will be gone.
David, what's in this for you? Unless you start selling those $60 a pound insects yourself, where is the financial advantage for you? Where's the compulsion to make this so much of a project?
I am paid to give presentations. But more to the point is, it's kind of fun to be a pioneer at something. It's something that serves the environment, so it's something that's green and bigger than myself. And there's a certain sense of fun that comes when you watch someone doing something that's new for them. And I'm making progress.
One restaurant at a time.
One taster at a time.
I was going to say one intern at a time.
Well, yeah.
That's David Gracer, entomophagist in Rhode Island. You can find his recipes for bug-based dinners at his website by going to ours, here-now.org. Also, Hamad Ahmed, here now intern, your keeper. Thanks.
We're not trying the Hormigas colonus on the air?
No, we're not.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
David, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Coming up, how musings can lead to scientific breakthroughs. That's in 1 minute, here and now. It's like watching paint dry. We've all said that, right, when something is slow or dull, but how does paint really dry? That's the kind of thing that our next guest, Lakshmi Narayanan Mayadevan, explores professionally. He's a professor of applied mathematics at Harvard University, and he doesn't stop at paint. He wants to know why paper crumples the way it does, or how the leaves of a Venus flytrap can fold fast enough to trap a fly, or why maps are so hard to fold. He's curious, but also he's a scientist, and these musings lead to breakthroughs. And Professor Mahadevan joins us in the studio with more. Let's start with the paint. How did you come up with that question, and what did you observe?
Well, it was a few years ago. I was in Paris, and some friends of mine were doing experiments on trying to understand how colloids, particles in liquid, clay, for example, mud, dries, cracks up and forms interesting patterns. Glazes do the same thing on fine porcelain. If you go to the art museum, you will see different kinds of cracks and paintings from different eras. So from a physical, mathematical perspective, one might ask, what are the conditions that actually lead to cracking? Sometimes it causes wrinkles instead of cracks. Can you predict what the distance between cracks is, for example? Can you control it? Because if I can control it, maybe I can do something beautiful.
Did you literally sit and watch paint dry?
I have done that. So everything from these little things that you see on paintings, which seem to be a nuisance, to these gigantic cracks in lava.
I have seen paint dry, and it kind of forms a skin. And
exactly.
Then there's like a bubble underneath it.
That's right.
So why is it important to know that a drop of paint will form a skin and then have a bubble underneath it that then dries?
I didn't say it was important.
But wait a minute, you're with Harvard. It's got to be important.
No, I mean... I think of these questions as being part of a continuum. You can ask questions about everything. One, as a child, does that. I mean, you start out by being curious. You can be curious about things which you can't touch, which you cannot see, things very far away. But you can also be curious about things in front of you.
Yeah. And just asking why. Why does that do that?
Exactly.
Well, you know, it's funny. We recently had David Sedaris on the program, the humorist, the essayist, and he keeps a list of what he calls nagging questions, like, why don't I ever see a baby squirrel? That's really part of what you're talking
That's
about.
That's right. If you don't mind my using the analogy to a child, you're born and you have a very limited number of observations that you've made initially, none when you were in your mother's womb. You come out and you start making observations about the world and you try to make sense of it. And the way you try to make sense of it and say, this is like this. So you're using analogy all the time. And you can do the same thing in science.
Can you give me an example in layman's terms of something that you observed in nature and asked a why about it and how that led you down some other path?
So the problem of studying wrinkles on skin is, I think, an example of that. I found that we could make a theory for this. I made a very simple model which explains, for example, the size of the wrinkle as a function of various parameters. And I realized that these wrinkles appear in many other places. I'm not the first one, but I started looking around. And you start looking at the Earth. So now you start to see patterns. You see mountains. And one can ask, are these mountains also wrinkled, but on a very large scale? And you realize maybe they are. And so we go the other way also. So I went from wrinkles on skin to wrinkles on tiny little tubes, the kinds of tubes that people now talk a lot about, carbon nanotubes. So if you think of take a rubber sheet and you roll it up into a tube, and then you bend it. And when you try and bend such an object, you find that the inside of it corrugates exactly like the dryer vent tube.
Got it.
And, of course, that's happening on the scale when you can handle it with your fingers, but people have done experiments where you can reduce the size by a factor of almost 10 million.
That's small.
Very, very small. And you see the same thing happening. And then you ask if that same thing's happening on the scale of the Earth, and it's also happening on the scale of my hands, and it's also happening on the scale of this very, very tiny object. Is there some general feature? And, you know, as scientists, we want to collapse as much explanation as we possibly can into something fairly simple that relates all these different pieces together.
And what do you learn about mountains and wrinkles from that?
Well, okay, so the mountain story is still very much a work in progress. We don't know. I'm working with a geologist to see whether any of these ideas are anything more than ideas at this point. But at the level of these very tiny tubes and at the level of skin, we learn that we can actually predict the sizes of the wrinkles, the shapes of the wrinkles. What good does that do you? I don't know. I mean, it satisfies an innate curiosity in me, certainly. It amuses a lot of my friends.
Can you just, for us now, just tick through some of the why questions that you've had? I mean, just, you know, think about the things you've looked at and just say, why does that do that?
Okay, yeah. How do fish swim? Okay, it's a question that people have asked. Many people have asked. Many people have tried to answer it. And we have our own take. And what's the question? So can we predict the speed of a fish if we knew its size, if we knew how the muscles were essentially operating inside it? A particular analogy, which I like to make often, is an analogy between a fish where the fish has little wiggles which move on along it and then cause the fish to move. And a different version of the same problem, almost the same problem, is if I had a flow past a static object, like a flag, then the flag starts to wiggle.
Mm-hmm.
So are there similarities in these two problems? Naively, you would say, there's nothing in common. You know, a fish is active, it's actually consuming energy and swimming through water. A flag is essentially fluttering in the breeze. But it turns out, mathematically, that the way you would think about both these is actually fairly closely related. And we'd previously worked on how flags flutter, and now we've used some of that knowledge to try and understand how fish might swim. And then you can ask questions about how they can do it in the best possible way, most efficiently.
So are you saying, because if I remember from reading about your flag work, something, you know, the wind that's blowing along a flag is making the flag oscillate.
Correct.
So are you saying that rather than the fish wiggling, the water passing by it is making it oscillate?
Well, it's a combination.
Yeah.
So the fish would start to wiggle, and once the fish wiggled, the water would start to move, and then the water pushes back on the fish. And this combination of the fish moving the water and the water pushing back on the fish then actually makes the fish move in a particular direction.
Mm. And we can go from there to how do snakes come out of water and wiggle along on land? And
exactly.
Yeah.
And then ask questions sort of if you wanted to zoom out. So we look at a fish, we look at a snail, we look at a snake. Are there general principles?
Huh.
Maybe you will see a pattern. Maybe we won't. I don't know. I don't know the answer. I mean, the greatest part of being able to pursue this way of living, literally, is that I don't know what will happen tomorrow. I have a little sort of favorite quote of mine, if I might.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it goes back to Samuel Johnson, the famous English lexicographer. Vulgar and inactive minds confound familiarity with knowledge. And everything that we see for some time in our lives is going to be for the first time. And Johnson sort of hit that on the head. There's one other, which is a wonderful quote, due to a very famous physiologist, Albert St. George. And he said that a discovery is seeing what everybody has seen, but thinking what nobody has thought.
That's Lakshmi Narayanan Mahadevan, professor of applied mathematics at Harvard University. Pretty much his profession is to ask why. Professor, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much, Robin.